The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, today on WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as a special guest someone visiting town who's been giving a lecture recently in Urbana-Champaign at the university, Gene Kilbourn. Someone who won't need an introduction to some of you, but some of you may not be familiar with Gene Kilbourn yet, but believe me, at the end of this hour, you're going to know a lot about her, what she has to say, and I think you're going to, what she has to say. And I think you'll be very interested in finding out about her work. Gene Kilbourn is internationally recognized for her pioneering work in alcohol and tobacco advertising and the image of women in advertising. Her films, slide lectures, and television appearances have been seen by millions of people throughout the world. She was named by the New York Times Magazine as one of the three most popular speakers on college campuses. Wow, who were the other two, do you know?
Maya Angelou was one.
Oh.
Can't remember the other one.
Oh, right. It wasn't me, though.
It wasn't, but it will be soon.
There you go. Gene Kilbourn's recent book, Can't Buy Me Love, How Advertising Changes the Way We Think and Feel, was called by Publishers Weekly a profound work that is required reading for informed consumers. It won the Distinguished Publication Award from the Association for Women in Psychology. Having read the book, I can vouch for that. It's a terrific book, and it really, I think, is the entry point if you want to get serious about understanding advertising. That's where you should go first.
Well, thank you. And
take it from there, but it really gets the discussion moving in the right direction. I think you're probably best known, Gene, if I can say so, at least how I first learned about you. It was from the documentary you did, Killing Us Softly, which is back in the mid to late 70s.
I first made Killing Us Softly in 1979. I remade it in 87 as still Killing Us Softly. And then a year or so ago, I made it yet again as Killing Us Softly 3.
In the first version, now we're in such a high-tech age. Oh, by the way, welcome, Gene.
Thank you.
Here we are,
it's good to be here.
Yeah. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Bob.
When I first saw Killing Softly, it was right in 1979 when it came out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were talking about it before we went on air. I mean, today we're so used to these sort of extraordinary high-tech values. And I know that the new videos you're working on for the Media Education Foundation is, you know, the highest quality professional standards. The first Killing Us Softly was just a tape of you giving a lecture with one camera, right?
That's right. It was one camera and it was one take. I didn't stop at all. I was giving a lecture at Holy Cross in Worcester, and they were there with a camera, and I just went through the lecture. They taped it or filmed it. Actually, it was on film. And then, we edited it down. It was about a 50-minute lecture. We edited it down to 30 minutes, released it. One take, one camera, and it's been maybe the most successful, certainly the most successful feminist film,
Absolutely.
Educational film of all time.
You know, it was an extraordinary impact. I mean, I remember, I thought it was early in the 70s, since the immediate impact, because in 1979, I remember seeing it, I remember people talking about it. And it was one of these films that when you watched it, your immediate response was, gosh, why wasn't this done before? I mean, this is so clear a problem. Why is it 1979 that people are finally talking about this? I mean, it was just so transparent, the issues. And, you know, what was the... But give a sense of what that was about and then what your work has been like since then, where the direction it's been on.
I actually started collecting ads in the late 60s. And it all began when I was had a job. I had a series of mindless jobs in the late 60s. I went to Wellesley College, but in those days, you know, after I graduated from Wellesley, I had to go to secretarial school in order to get a job. So I had a series of mindless jobs.
Unbelievable.
It is, really, when you think about it. That wasn't that long ago. And one of the jobs was putting ads into The Lancet, the British medical journal. Mm-hmm. And one of the ads was an ad for birth control pills. And it showed a smiling woman's face. She looks very much like a Stepford wife. And the copy says, Ovulin 21 works the way a woman thinks, by weekdays, not by cycle days. So the ad was very explicitly saying to physicians, all of whom were male in those days, that women were too stupid to remember our cycles, but we could remember the days of the week. And then to help a woman out, in her head there was a box for every day of the week. So Monday had a laundry basket, Tuesday had an iron. And I looked at this ad, this was 1968 or something like that, and I knew there was something wrong with it. I mean, it was clearly demeaning to women. And I took it home and I put it on my refrigerator. And then I began to collect other ads. I didn't intend to make a career of it. I was just very interested in what the images were and began to see a pattern in the pictures and began to really think that this was a much more important issue. No one at that in those days was looking at it or taking it seriously. But I became very interested and intrigued, and that led to my gradually speaking out about it and then finally making the film in 79.
And what sort of, I mean, just to summarize, what was the key things you found? I mean, obviously demeaning to women, but it went even beyond just
types
of demeaning, but also way beyond it. What were the key things you found? And then as you said, are they still there?
They're very much still there. Yeah. I think a couple of key things. One was the tyranny of the beauty image, you know, basically that, and this was, you know, again, long before Naomi Wolf and long before mm-hmm. people were thinking about this, that there was enormous pressure on women. It's much greater today than it was then, but it still existed then, to achieve a certain kind of impossible ideal. And even then, it was about in the 70s that it began to be an ideal that skewed toward extreme thinness, and that, of course, has gotten worse too. Another thing that struck me early on was that turning women into objects in this way and using their bodies to sell absolutely everything from chewing gum to chainsaws set women up for violence in a way that's subtle but I think very important, which is that whenever you turn a human being into a thing, into an object, you of course invite violence. Mm-hmm. And the fact that this is done constantly, that wherever we look in our culture, we see women's bodies presented as things, I think creates a climate in which there's widespread and increasing violence against women.
Yeah, use the bodies for male pleasure.
Use the bodies for male pleasure, and also the woman is dehumanized, yeah. You know, which has no, and when you dehumanize someone, why not abuse them? I mean, mm-hmm. if it's a thing, it's mm-hmm. easy to abuse the thing. So that, I think it's a cultural climate that really encourages violence against women. So that was another thing mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. seemed very clear. And yet another was that in those days, there was also the beginning of the sexualization of children, of little girls in particular, using little girls made up in very provocative poses and that sort of thing. And it struck me that this was partly a response to feminism, to mm-hmm. the second wave of feminism, mm-hmm. that if women were going to become more powerful, that we were literally going to be replaced by little girls, and that real little girls then became endangered. And so this seemed to me related. The fact that women were being told at that time in the 70s that we needed to start being very thin, and also that little girls were increasingly sexualized, was a kind of response to the threat of women becoming too powerful.
Mm-hmm. So feminism didn't necessarily make advertising more sympathetic to the situation women face in our society, but instead turned it around to some extent to make it more difficult, I mean, to put them in a worse situation.
In some ways it did. And the other thing that happened, of course, in response to feminism was that advertisers rushed in to co-opt feminism. Mm-hmm. And the most notorious example is Virginia Slim's You've yeah. Come a Long Way, Baby. But there were so many. I mean, in the original Killing Us Softly, I remember an ad that says, shows a young woman, it says, "So you're out to change the world, we can do it together." And it's an ad for shoe coloring. You know? So it was a constant co-optation of, and that still goes on. You know,
have you read Tom Frank's Conquest of Cool?
Yes, yeah.
That sort of, Tom was a recent guest on our show, and mm-hmm. that was a book that talks about how advertising takes sort of progressive social ideas and turns them around, twists them around to use, and sort of then strips them of their actual meaning.
Absolutely. And I mean, certainly done this with the environmental movement, yeah. for example, all these green companies and green products. That,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
The sad thing is that so many people fall for it, you know, that they end up believing somehow that these corporations really do care about yeah. the environment or really are progressive in some way.
Well, when you think about it, if you're exposed to advertising constantly, and you know the figures are quite extraordinary, the amount of advertising messages you're exposed to on a daily or weekly basis, mm-hmm. and there's nothing on the other side really, over time it's just logical it would have some effect.
And of course we're exposed to, the average American is exposed to 3,000 ads a day, and will spend 2 or 3 years of his or her life watching television commercials. So you're right, we're just sort of awash in these images all the time. But at the same time, we all believe we're not influenced.
Yeah.
And that is what makes us more influenced, of mm-hmm. course, is that as long as they can sort of convince us that, hey, this isn't really important, we're not really being influenced, then we're not on guard and we're more likely to be influenced by it. Now, I'm certainly not saying in my work that we're robots or that we're brainwashed. And I never say that we look at an ad and then go off and do something
yeah.
very specific.
Yeah.
But it's a cumulative unconscious impact of being surrounded by these messages all the time. And as you say, there's no other side. It's not like there's some other sort of message that
there's
we're getting.
There's no debate going on.
There's no debate going yeah. on. This is it, you know. I mean, the happiness is what you buy. Products yeah. can fulfill you. The point of life is to accumulate as much stuff as possible.
Now, that's a really good point you just raised. I mean, happiness is what you buy. The point of life is to accumulate things and have more than someone else. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, does that really explain, in the end, why these themes are used? Why not, you know, tell women, and why not have messages and products advertised to women that, you know, have feminist messages that, you know, tells them you're fine just the way you are.
Because if you're fine just the way you are, you don't need to buy all this stuff.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think so built into it is this, you've got to say there's something wrong with you.
There has to be. I mean, that most advertising for most products has to arouse anxiety about something, mm-hmm. which is then going to be alleviated by buying the product. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's very direct. Oh, my God, you look old. You better use this anti-wrinkle cream, or you're gaining weight. You better use this diet product. Sometimes it's even more insidious in some ways. You know, you're lonely, you're isolated, have a cigarette, have another drink, you know, that kind of thing. But always the subtext is there's something wrong with you, and you need to buy something to make yourself okay.
And in fact, in some of your work, in your book and in your slideshows and in your videos, you show these ads and talk about these ads that are so explicit, where they're saying to women, and I think this is applied to men too, but these are ads aimed at women, you know, this product is more rewarding than a relationship with another person. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't count on another person, but you know, you spend X dollars for this brand of cigarette.
Right.
They won't betray you.
Like the cigarette ad where the woman, this attractive but tough-looking woman, looks out and says, "Until I find a real man, I'll settle for a real smoke." But that's one of the themes in my book, actually. I know, but that's a lot of them are funny. You know, I've been saying for years, and by now it's pretty well known, that advertising objectifies people, particularly women, but increasingly men.
That's right.
But it turns into objects. But it does something now that's a little different from that. It sexualizes products, and it encourages us to have a relationship with products rather than with people. So we're encouraged to feel passion for our products rather than our partners. And I have so many examples of this in the book, but one of my favorites is a car ad that says, "You can love it without getting your heart broken." And, of course, you can't say that about a human being. So the idea is that you can have risk-free love.
Yeah.
Or that you can – there's another car ad that says lots of significant others, one car. Mm. You can commit to a car. You can't commit to a relationship. Or another one that shows a young man in four different photographs. And each one he's with a different young woman. And the copy says, "Who says guys are afraid of commitment? He's had the same backpack for years." And in every photograph, he's got the same backpack but a different woman. So that it's really, individually, they're silly, they're funny, they're clever, but the cumulative message that we can commit to brands but not to people, I think is really an insidious and dangerous one.
Yeah, one way I like to think about that is imagine if we had 3,000 messages a day that basically were about white supremacy.
Right.
Instead of about something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's like 3,000. No one paid attention to them. You knew they were paid for by the Nazi Party or the Ku Klux Klan.
Mm-hmm.
See, I don't listen to those. But and kids are exposed to them, too. Mm-hmm. But who would think that if you had 3,000 really well-made ads, too, not really garish over the top, but the smartest brains in the world trying to plant the idea that white people are superior to all of the races.
Mm-hmm.
You know, would it have an effect? Of course it would.
Of course it would. I mean, it's undeniable that it would have an effect.
I mean, it would have an extraordinary effect.
I often say, I mean, what if Budweiser took its incredible budget and tried to sell sobriety? What a difference that would make if we had commercials on TV during sports games and that sort of thing about the pleasures of a sober life, you know, that kind of thing. That would work too, I think.
Yeah, that would have a lot of
effect. It would have an impact.
We're talking to Jean Kilbourn today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Thank you for joining us today. This is a pre-recorded show. Jean graciously joined us in the studio to tape a show while she was in town giving an interview, or giving a lecture, I should say, recently. Mm-hmm. So we aren't taking calls, so to sit back, make a cup of tea. Certainly don't have a drink, not until the show. Not an advertised drink, at least. Mm-hmm. Make a cup of tea, sit back, relax, enjoy the show, and let Jean and I do the talking today. When you look at ads, do you find that there's a difference in terms of the image of women specifically or human sexuality in the ads that are pitched for products largely to women and to men? You know, because there seems like advertisers break down the target audience for a lot of products. Some products are for women, some are for men. Both use sexuality, but do they use it differently?
In some ways they do. They use female sexuality in ads that target women as well as men, mm-hmm. which is interesting. I mean, if you look at the women's magazines, for example, they're filled with ads featuring nude women or semi-nude women. And often people say to me, "What's that about? You know, men aren't reading Vogue, men aren't reading Cosmo." And I think what it's about really is what John Berger talks about in Ways of Seeing, one of my favorite books and one that really influenced me years ago, which is that women. We've internalized in our minds a critic looking at our bodies, what he calls the surveyor,
mm-hmm.
and that all women carry this little man, in a sense, inside our brain, looking at us, judging us, and that the ads then in women's magazines that feature nude women are saying to that part of our brain, you need to look like this in order to be attractive to men.
Yeah.
And so that's what's going on there. It's more complex. There's an extra step than an ad in the man's magazine, which shows a nude woman, which is really just saying, you know, use this product and you can get lots of sex, or you can have this woman,
yeah,
or this woman is linked with this product. So for women, there's this extra step. It's appealing to this little internalized critic. Women have an extraordinary amount of negative self-talk that goes on all the time. I mean, I think it's safe to say that, I mean, this is not based on research, but 85% of all women begin every day with a bout of self-loathing, mm-hmm, looking in the mirror, mm-hmm, about what's wrong with our faces, what's wrong with our bodies. And the ads, in a way, address that. They're sort of saying, you know, yes, you're right. I mean, you do, mm-hmm, you are flabby. You do have cellulite.
Advertisers play on that.
They play
anxiety,
on that.
They
exacerbate it and they play upon it.
But they don't necessarily create it, do they?
I don't think they create it, but they... and I don't think they really create anything out of thin air, but they do a great deal more than just reflect it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, advertisers select certain values, certain attitudes to reflect,
yeah,
for one thing.
Yeah, that's a good point, because they, mm-hmm, could select other ones.
Oh, easily.
And blow those up, and that would, right, probably have much more beneficial effect, but those aren't commercially
viable. Well, the most obvious example is materialism. I mean, that the only values that advertising ever reflects are materialistic. I mean, they're certainly not going to reflect spiritual values. They'll co-opt spiritual values to sell you something, but they're certainly not going to say, hey, are you feeling unhappy? Take a walk, you know. I mean, they might say put on these $130 running shoes and go take a walk, but they won't say take a walk.
Yeah.
And they'll certainly never say, you know, thirsty, have water,
yeah,
you know, unless it's bottled, expensive water.
Yeah.
But so they're not going to reflect anything that doesn't ultimately make money for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself then sells us something. It sells us the idea, again, that things that we can buy happiness, or that we have to buy things in order to get these needs met.
Now, this is a powerful argument, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the recent videos, the ones you're working on now in your book. But, you know, this is controversial stuff to Madison Avenue. I mean, I suspect that, you know, your name is not, like, held in high esteem in the corridors of the largest ad agencies.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, you know, you've got a huge following. A lot of people are influenced by your work, including myself. How do advertisers, or people who teach advertising, people who work in the field, what sort of response have you gotten?
Well, it's actually been mixed, of course. I've done quite a few presentations for ad clubs and ad groups. I'm not overwhelmed with invitations, but I do get some and I do take them, various art directors groups and things like that. And mostly the response has been positive. I mean, they really can't deny that what I'm saying is fundamentally true. I mean, people can quibble about an interpretation of an ad or not, but you can't really say that there's no truth at all to this. And mostly what they do, which is very human, is pass the buck. You know, the art directors say, well, it's the account executives, and the account executives say, we're just giving people what they want, that sort of thing. There are people certainly within...
Giving people what they want? If you're giving them what they want, they wouldn't have any ads.
Well, but they say that people are demanding this kind of advertising.
Oh, yeah. I see people rallying outside.
That's right. They want more. They want, bring it on, exploit me more. So I think that there certainly are some people within the advertising field who are concerned about these issues and who are, you know, trying in their own ways to bring about change. I don't have access to the people who really have the power. And as you know better than just about anybody, the power is really concentrated in the hands of very few people,
yeah,
no matter what you're talking about, the advertising industry or the media. And those are the people who really call the shots, and they're not the kind of people who are going to pay any attention to what I'm saying.
Well, right? You're totally irrelevant to them. They're just out to... Push
right,
the bottom
I'm a little
line,
gadfly,
period.
Right? Yeah. They're not going to, but they can make sure that I don't get a lot of publicity.
Mm-hmm.
They can make sure that this point of view never gets really aired or discussed. They don't really have to worry. It seems to me they have to worry less and less all the time.
Have they ever asked you to be in an ad to pay, give you money?
No,
I know it sounds absurd, but, you know, Ralph Nader,
well,
you probably
know.
Heard that story. He was offered, I think, by Nike, some absurd figure, like $100,000. Just to stand in an ad a couple years ago and say Nike exploits workers, and then they would sort of make fun of him. He turned it down, obviously.
I'm sure he did. Wow. No, I, you know, although years ago, part of what got me into this whole issue of being interested in the image of women was that I was a model when I was very young.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, and it was fairly high powered. I modeled in London and Paris and New York and, you know, for some well-known fashion designers.
Did you ever make it to Champagne in those days?
I didn't make it to Champagne in those days.
Okay.
And I didn't do it for long because it was so dehumanizing and alienating. And even though there was no language in those days to describe those feelings, it was pretty awful. And there was an enormous amount of sexual harassment. They're just off the charts. But it was also one of the few ways a woman could make a lot of money, still is. And particularly then. I mean, my options graduating from Wellesley were I could be a secretary, I could be a teacher, I could be a nurse, you know, and I could make zip, or I could, you know, be a model and make a whole lot of money.
I mean, it's still mind-boggling.
And so I did it for a while. And what it did was it left me with a lifelong interest in the power of the image and the whole idea of where does this image come from, and also with the clear sense that there are no winners. That even if you achieve this look when you're young, and you can only achieve it when you're young, it's very short-lived, and there's a high price to pay for it. So in that sense, I guess I was in some ads and I did some things like that. But that was, as I said, a very long time ago. I would like to think that I have no price these days that they could pay me.
No, I think you're beyond that.
I hope so.
Yeah, I think it would sort of undercut your credibility, to put it mildly.
Yes.
You know, it's funny you should mention the thing about age. Maybe it's with my own advancing years, but I noticed the last time I saw you give a presentation, you talked about ageism. I sort of don't like terms like that in a way that sort of to classify all these things, but
it's hard to find other terms.
Yeah, it is. But
it's like weightism. I mean, that's a terrible. What an ungainly word that is. Yeah. But how else do you say it? Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, the point that you made, and I think it's an important one, was that as people grow older, they stop being sexual beings, and they're sort of like, you know, the idea of middle-aged or older people having sexual relationships or sexual lives is sort of like, you know, it's like taboo. Only people who look great can have sex. It's sort of like you have to pass some sort of litmus test of physical beauty and youth before you're entitled to have an orgasm.
Right. That's why I strongly feel that here we are, a culture that's drenched in sexual images. I mean, just phenomenal sexual images all the time, very blatant, everywhere, used to sell everything. And yet I feel that the ultimate impact of all these images is profoundly unerotic.
Yeah.
Because what it really does is it makes most of us feel much less desirable.
Mm-hmm.
And sex, if you'd have to conclude if you were from Mars and you came and looked at our popular culture, that first of all, sex is the most important thing in life. And secondly, that it belongs only to the young and beautiful. You literally never see images of people who aren't young and perfect looking having sex or even having sexual thoughts. Or if they do, they're ridiculed.
Yeah.
So what a message that is, that as you grow older, you lose your sexuality. And again, I think, first of all, this is profoundly untrue. If anything, sexuality becomes more profound, more important, more whatever, as one grows older. But it also, I think, really does make people feel less desirable, and I think it's related to the fact that there's a phenomenal amount of sexual dysfunction in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people feeling, one of the biggest complaints that people have sexually, apparently, is lack of desire.
Yeah.
What an interesting thing in the middle of all this, you know, hot stuff that so many people suffer from, sort of inhibited desire. But how could that not be true, given that, you know, most of us never see ourselves reflected?
Yeah, and advertising, it doesn't create the problem, but it certainly doesn't abate it.
And it's not just advertising. In this case, it's everything.
The whole...
I mean, the sitcoms and the films and everything else. Again, all these, you know, young, perfect-looking people having all these fabulous sexual experiences, and yet for once you're over a certain age or if you're not perfect-looking, forget it. You know, you have no sexuality.
We're talking to Jean Kilbourn today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-taped, or I guess it has to be pre-taped, if it's a tape show that we're playing, when Jean Kilbourn was in town giving a lecture. So we aren't taking calls today. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show. You know, Jean, this gets to, I mean, the point you just made about how these themes aren't just in the advertising, but they permeate the entertainment culture, the culture, the media culture. It seems like, and you alluded to this earlier, that what we're seeing from like the 1960s to today has been a real shift in a lot of ways, in the sense that it used to be, at a sense, here's the programming, then there's this wall, and then the other side's the ad. And when you did your show, your first tape and stuff, you could say, oh, here's the ad, and just sort of concentrate on that and not worry about the show. But it seems like that what we're seeing is the two are increasingly sort of merging together. You were talking about now how advertising tries to make brands have a relationship with the – I mean, it's not like a product anymore that's going to gargle with it or put it in your engine or something, but rather something you're going to have a personal bond with.
You can count on.
You can count on. And the shows, the sitcoms, the movies – have the same sort of look and feel as the ads do. They're made by the same people oftentimes. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, it's hard almost to distinguish them. I mean, is this something you're wrestling with in your work and analysis?
Absolutely. And I think that it's there's so many things to say about that. I mean, the most obvious is product tie-ins, you know, where they, mm-hmm. in films and in sitcoms and TV shows and that sort of thing, they actually embed products. They use products in the shows, and that people don't realize that this is paid for. It's hype. It's you know, it's all part of it's an ad. And we're going to see more and more of this, I'm sure, as there are more and more technology enables us to skip commercials. Mm-hmm. I mean, now you can even, you know, with you know, what are they, personal video recorders?
Yeah,
you can
TiVo.
You can TiVo and that sort of thing. You can even just eliminate the commercials altogether. Well, yeah. This must have advertisers, you know, really scared to death. So what they're going to have to do is put the messages into the shows. Mm-hmm. So we'll have Jennifer Aniston on Friends offering, you know, Courtney Cox a Diet Pepsi, mm-hmm. rather than breaking for the Diet Pepsi. You know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'll have things more and more. There's an ad I use now in my show that's a fashion layout that shows – it's not an ad, allegedly. It's a fashion layout. Shows a very thin supermodel just sitting on the edge of a counter, and right beside her is Dexatrim, the pills. Hmm. And this is not an ad, but they're the diet pills. So mm-hmm. the message is very clear. And I think we're going to see more and more of this. And also – beyond this, of course, is the extent to which we're becoming increasingly a market-driven culture no matter what it is.
Yeah.
So as you say,
every aspect.
Yeah. And, of course, the most frightening example to me, and I'm sure to you too, especially this week, is what it's done to political discourse in this country, mm-hmm. that so many people now, and we've just seen the results, from my point of view, of course, very depressingly in this election, in all these elections, that the extent to which people vote against their own best interests because they're taken in by the hype and by the advertising, and that advertising, far from being trivial, actually is the most important aspect these days of the media, and it's becoming the most important aspect of politics.
And as Seth Jolly, who you've worked with and has been a guest in this show, who runs the Media Education Foundation that puts out the wonderful videos in Massachusetts, likes to point out, the amount of money that goes into an ad or thinking about advertising is much greater than the comparable amount of money spent on the same amount of time for an entertainment show or a film. I mean, this is mm-hmm. really where the top brains are. You know, they don't just guess or wing it.
Right.
If you go to a major ad agency in New York or Chicago, what you'll find is an enormous bank of people doing research on how to get into women's heads and men's heads and teenagers' heads and especially children's heads. How mm-hmm. What button you can push to sort of tattoo that brand into that brain, hardwire it so that mm-hmm. they will be going to the store and buying that product. And it's not just sort of hit and miss. I mean, it is. I had a friend, for example, who went up to the Leo Burnett Agency last summer and did a visit there to sort of size it up. And he said they had an enormous wing of researchers working just on how to sell to children, not even for specific clients, just so they'd have this bank of research mm-hmm. going down to year and a half old, gender breakdown between boys and girls, ethnic class breakdown, the whole works. What message works with each group, mm-hmm. just so they could know how to sell. I mean, it's quite a...
I think it's pretty frightening, and it's also something I think most people aren't aware of,
yeah,
the amount of psychological research that goes into this, the billions of dollars. I know the American Psychological Association, one wing of it at least, is really trying to make this an issue. I mean, how ethical is it for psychologists to use their skills in this way, to run little focus groups in order to help marketers sell? Now, in some instances, it's pretty obviously unethical. If they're trying to target 12-year-old girls with a new cigarette, for example, should psychologists be lending their skills to this effort? I don't think so.
Yeah.
But they are. And yeah. So therefore, these ads are very carefully planned and designed. Some people may have seen the show a year or so ago called The Merchants of Cool about how the advertisers now are hiring young people to go into the communities and sort of hang out with the skateboarders, the PBS documentary, right, The Merchants of Cool, and to just sort of find out what's hip and what's trendy and to use – and this is a kind of focus group. But kids, of course, don't know that they're participating in this focus group. So they really are using our own stuff against us in a way to create very powerful selling messages designed to affect each one of us mostly unconsciously and, of course, designed to get beneath the radar so mm-hmm. that we're thinking, oh, ads are stupid, they're trivial, I'm not influenced, and then the ads are coming right in to influence mm-hmm. us and to sell us not just products but to sell us all kinds of attitudes and values.
That are conducive to ultimately buying these products and identifying with them.
Right.
We're talking to Gene Kilbourn again on Media Matters, the expert in advertising, who was recently in town giving a lecture and has graciously come by the studio. And let's go through a few of the areas that you've really put a lot of your analysis in, a lot of work. And let's start with women's body types and slimness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from afar, you know, looking at this issue, you look at women in the 1950s, for example. I mean, you've heard this, so you've probably said it. Mm-hmm. I'm probably lifting it from you. So forgive me if I am.
That's right.
But, you know, you look at what was considered a starlet in 1950 or 1952, a Marilyn Monroe or a Jane Russell.
Mm-hmm.
And by today's standards, I mean, they'd be considered like porkers. I mean, they wouldn't even be let on the studio lot.
Right.
They'd be immediately shipped off to some place to lose 30 pounds or something.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And today, on the other mm-hmm. hand, you know, it seems that if you're a woman who wants to have a successful career in the public eye, you'd better be awfully skinny, or mm-hmm. you're not even going to get through the door, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And advertising, I mean, where does advertising fit into this?
Well, I think it plays a very big role, and that there are several things that went on that sort of, I think, contribute to this sort of real shift in the standard of beauty for women. And one is the rise of a huge diet industry, a $60 billion diet industry. People discovered they could make an awful lot of money if they got women hooked on trying to achieve an ideal that's impossible. And, of course,
$60 billion.
And none of the products work. If they did, believe me, if there were a diet that worked, everybody would be on
yeah.
it. So the products don't work, but they're perfect for selling to people because people keep using them, and then they might lose a little bit of weight, then they put the weight back on, then they go back to them. So you've got a built-in kind
yeah,
of clientele.
Or switch to another product.
Or they switch to another product, try something else. So that's one thing that happens. On a deeper level,
The key to successful diet is just stop buying a lot of food.
Stop buying junk food
yeah,
is one
yeah,
place to start.
Yeah.
And actually, the junk food industry and the diet industry are almost in cahoots, really,
mm-hmm.
because here we've got a multi-billion-dollar food industry that's selling Americans on the idea of huge portions of food that's horrible for us
mm-hmm.
and that makes us fat. And then the diet industry that's allegedly is going to help us lose the weight, but of course isn't really going to help us lose the weight. It's ideal from an advertiser's point of view. On a deeper level, I do think as I said earlier, that the obsession with thinness for women is related to fear of women being too powerful, and
mm-hmm.
that it's no coincidence that it happened, came along at the same time that women were making some gains. And so even the language that we use to describe it, I mean, that women shouldn't be too full of themselves, shouldn't throw our weight around, you know, that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
that it's all right, okay, honey, you can be a lawyer, you can be a doctor, but you better be frail physically. You better not take up too much space. I even have an ad that shows a young woman on a treadmill, and it says, soon you'll both be taking up less space. The idea that women shouldn't take up too much space. Or another one, a fashion ad showing a very thin woman, and the copy says, the more you subtract, the more you add. The
mm-hmm.
idea that women should be smaller. And I think that this is related to the drop in self-esteem that girls experience when they hit adolescence, the messages that they get that they shouldn't be too powerful, too big. And it does enormous harm. There's been an explosion of eating disorders in the culture, which I think by now everybody knows.
Yeah.
And about one survey found that 80% of fourth grade girls were on diets. So
I know, I've heard
it's
that.
Just, you
know, I
it's incredible.
Being a father of two daughters, it's something I pay a lot of attention
to. So you hear it all the
to.
Time.
Yeah.
I mean, my daughter's 15. When she was 7 and 8, her friends started talking about being too fat.
Oh, I know.
Started saying they couldn't wear shorts in the summer because their thighs were too heavy. It broke my heart.
No, you just work triple time trying to make your kids not have to deal with that.
Right.
But the pressures are it's like trying to hold back a tidal wave with a ping pong paddle.
It is. And now at the same time, many people are going to hear this and say, wait a second, the real problem in this culture is obesity. Well, obesity is a huge problem. A third of adult Americans are obese. Two-thirds are overweight. Kids are obese. But the solution isn't dieting. You know, the solution isn't for people to become obsessed with thinness. It's really flip sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
It really comes down to the fact that as a culture, we eat really badly. And we
mm-hmm.
don't exercise enough. We drive our cars too much, and we watch too much TV. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, and we're beholden to this huge junk food industry.
Yeah.
So that it's really related. And a lot of times when what happens is people want to be very thin, so they go on a diet. It might work a little bit, but then inevitably, diets are always a bad idea because they always lead to binging. You're always going to get sick of a diet and say, to hell with it, I'm going to have, you
yeah.
know, 11 cupcakes. And then you give up.
Yeah.
Whereas if people want to really maintain a healthy weight, what it requires is just long-term changes in the way that we eat and exercise.
Yeah, permanent changes.
Permanent changes.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be grim. I mean,
yeah.
one of the things that really depresses me about life these days for young women in particular is that they can't take pleasure in eating. And it seems to me that food should be one of life's great pleasures. You know, if
yeah.
you have, you know, I I love to travel. I love going to Italy. It's one of my favorite countries. You spend some time there, and you discover the joy of eating. You know, mm-hmm. you don't want to come back to mm-hmm. the land of processed food, mm-hmm. and you know, because the food just tastes so good. And you know, people aren't. It doesn't make you fat. You're satisfied.
Yeah,
you know?
And I guess in a way, this is really one of the most depressing turns, because in the sense that the feminist movement in the 60s was all about sort of. Not all about, but a large part of it was about making women not be so self-conscious of their appearance, just being mm-hmm. letting be who you want to be, and men too, for that matter. And that's mm-hmm. and it not only has gotten worse, as you point out, with the contribution of advertising. I mean, one of the ironies of this is that men now, I think, are vastly more self-conscious about their physical appearance than they were 30 or 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, when you looked at men like 30 or 40 years ago, these little skinny arms and sunken chest, that was considered okay for a male lead. Now you've got to, like, you know, be in the gym 4 hours a day,
right.
you know, buffed up, or else you're not, you know, you have to meet this new standard for men.
Absolutely. And that, particularly the pressures on young men and boys, yeah. of course. After a certain point for men, how you look doesn't matter anymore. All that matters is how
Thank
much
God.
Money you make.
yeah.
Which is, has its own set
God.
Of problems,
yeah.
right?
Absolutely.
But at least how you look doesn't matter so much.
Yeah.
But for boys, there is enormous pressure to
we've
bulk
had a
up.
Burst in the steroid problem with
yes.
high school, junior
mm-hmm.
high school and high school kids. Similar, not as much as anorexia. I don't want to. Mm-hmm. put it necessarily at the same level, but
right.
still it's a noticeable change.
There's a noticeable change. And more men have eating disorders, too. It's still about 10% of people with eating disorders are male, but, you know, that's too many. And certainly there's pressure on boys. And it's an interesting pressure that for boys are supposed to be bigger, of course. They're supposed
yeah.
to be bigger, stronger, more powerful. Girls yeah. are supposed to be smaller, weaker, less powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very, you know, these are age-old, insidious gender stereotypes at work here, too.
That, mm-hmm.
But, of course, it's an ideal image that's impossible for boys to achieve, too. You know, very few boys, even if they take steroids and work out, can achieve the kind of body types that you see routinely in Calvin Klein underwear ads these days. You know, it's not possible.
But, you know, I just you hear you talk about this, and I see this, and I'm saying, you know, as you said, I mean, there are other values that could be emphasized. This isn't mm-hmm. the be-all, end-all of our culture and society, of mm-hmm. the human existence. I mean, there are other attributes men and women have had traditionally that could be emphasized that are very positive but don't get emphasized, that mm-hmm. just aren't there in the ads.
Well, they wouldn't make anybody rich.
Yeah,
you know?
There's just not money to be made.
They wouldn't make anybody rich. And again, it comes down to the fact that if we felt we were okay the way we are, we wouldn't be driven to buy a lot of this stuff.
And the best things about us probably aren't commercially exploitable.
I don't think so. They're co-optable,
yeah.
you know, but I don't.
But concern for others.
Yeah, concern for others. Yeah, right. Exactly. Sensitivity.
Sense of justice,
fair yeah. play, all of that character. You know, they can all be alluded to in ads in various ways. The advertisers can attempt to yoke these things with products, but in fact, they're not really.
We're talking to Jean Kilbourn today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a tape show. We interviewed Jean when she was in town recently to give a lecture. So don't call in. Just sit back and relax. We've got about 15 or 16 minutes left to carry on with our discussion here. And, you know, addiction is the subject you've been working on a lot recently. I know
mm-hmm.
it's a new video you're working on for Media Education Foundation. It deals with addiction and advertising.
Mm-hmm.
What's the relationship there?
I think it's profound, the relationship between advertising and addiction. On the most obvious level, advertising often sells addictive products or potentially addictive products, tobacco, alcohol, food, you know, can be used in that way. Advertising, it also could be said, you know, sells addiction to spending, to buying, to consuming, so that we have a culture in which addiction plays an enormously important role, that addiction is of all kinds, sex addiction, debt, spending addiction, alcoholism, drug addiction, is huge.
It's a big part of our economy.
It's a huge part of our economy. And that's the thing, that addiction is both extraordinarily destructive. I think probably the most, our major public health problem and our most destructive problem, the effect that it has on families and that sort of thing is just devastating for generations. And yet, it also is good for the economy. That, you know, the addict is the best customer.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I say in my book is that whenever an addict recovers, someone loses money. you know, whether it's the pusher on the boardroom or the pusher on the corner.
Yeah.
You know, so when a person quits smoking, that's good news for the smoker, bad news for Philip Morris. Mm-hmm. You know, when you quit drinking, it's good news for the drinker, bad news for, you know, Anheuser-Busch.
Thank God these cigarette companies aren't advertising to kids anymore.
Oh, yeah, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure glad they agreed to stop
Boy, it's just amazing that they still – it's amazing that the tobacco industry still gets away with what it gets away with, you know, with all that we know. $8 billion they spend every year on advertising and promotion. They, of course, heavily target children still.
Because, I mean, the decision to become a smoker is made – overwhelmingly by people who are adolescent.
90% of all smokers start before they're 18. 60% start before high school. So if you don't start when you're very young, you're not going to start. And so, they have to get 3,000 children to start smoking every day just to replace those smokers who die or quit.
Die from cigarette-related diseases?
Yeah. A 1,000 smokers die every day. 2,000 quit. So they need 3,000 children to replace
them. The baton death march of tobacco.
It is. It's amazing. And it goes on and on. And the tobacco industry continues to use it. And not only in this country, of course, but globally what's happening is a real tragedy where there's less concern about health issues. There aren't warning labels, that kind of thing. The tobacco industry is just running wild.
Yeah, but in the case of tobacco, I see sort of ads periodically telling people not to smoke.
Oh, so, I mean, do you? Yes, and they're so cleverly done, aren't they? The evidence is pretty clear that the so-called anti-smoking ads that are put on by the tobacco industry are designed to get kids to smoke.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're actually designed to make it more
Can you give
attractive.
An example?
Well, the most obvious example would be an ad, and there was one from sort of Philip Morris, I think, did this, something like, kids shouldn't smoke. Smoking's for grown-ups. Oh, that'll do the trick, won't it? What kid would ever want to be mistaken for a grown-up, right? I mean, it's just – it's that so blatant. But some of the others are a little more subtle. But what they really are doing in the guise of saying kids shouldn't smoke is they're making the product even more of a forbidden fruit. Yeah. They're linking it more with being grown-up. And if you want to see anti-tobacco ads that work, you need to look at the counter-advertising that has nothing to do with the tobacco industry. The Truth Campaign, for example, which the tobacco industry hates, is even suing to try and get them to stop. Because these ads are effective. The body bags, you know, outside Philip Morris headquarters. The ads that ran in Massachusetts and California. The ads featuring, you know, two cowboys on horses and the copy says, Bob, I've got emphysema. You know, that kind of thing. Those ads really have an impact.
My all-time favorite ad is the one that was in Adbusters about a decade ago, which shows a cemetery and a horse standing there. It's this Marlboro Country.
Right, the riderless horse.
Oops, I don't think we're going to get any underwriting from Philip Morris.
Yeah, I don't think you had to worry too much about that anyway.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
So the tobacco industry's sort of attempts, and also the tobacco industry's, the amount they're spending on public relations, I mean, we could do a whole show on this, of course, too, on the amount that corporations spend on PR these days in order to really distort public opinion. So the tobacco industry is really trying to make it seem as if, hey, we care, we're not going to try and target kids, we're supporting all kinds of arts groups and ethnic groups and that kind of thing to buy innocence by association and to make us confused about their real nature.
One of the things that's confusing is a lot of people see these anti-smoking ads and they say, okay, well, there's a sort of balance now. There's smoking ads and anti-smoking. Mm-hmm. But in fact, for every dollar spent on an anti-smoking ad, I think there's something like $100 spent on
Easily.
Easily. The difference is maybe
And even
1,000.
Worse, again, the anti-smoking ads are designed to make kids smoke.
Yeah.
Now, when a company like Philip Morris gives money to domestic violence programs, for example, and sometimes people say, hey, that's a nice thing to do. Well, my understanding is they gave maybe $300,000 to domestic violence programs in this country, and they spent $5 million advertising that fact.
Yeah.
It's all about PR.
It's cause-related marketing.
It is. And it certainly works for them, but it's really dangerous for the rest of us. We should probably talk about some of what we can do about all of this.
I sure want to. Let's talk about alcohol just for a second.
Sure.
Then let's talk about what we can do about it.
Okay.
Because you're absolutely right. I do want to talk about that. I don't want people to leave the show and just jump off a bridge.
Exactly right.
Because I'm an optimist, and I know you are, and there's a lot we can do. I mean, the reason we do this criticism is to understand how things work so we can change them.
Right, absolutely.
But quickly about alcohol, because I think that is – the figures there with the addiction are absolutely astonishing.
Right. Well, I think the most important thing – if I could tell people just one statistic about alcohol, the most important by far is that 10% of drinkers consume 60% of all the alcohol sold. So 10% of the drinking population is doing 60% of the drinking. Now, that's true in the country. It's true here at, you know, the university. 10% of the students are doing 60% of the drinking. 30% of drinkers do 90% of the drinking. So what this means is that a relatively small percentage of people are doing most of the drinking. Well, That means, of course, most of these people are in trouble. They're alcoholics or they're high-risk drinkers. Now, when the alcohol industry says, we want people to use our product in moderation, you know, they will never define what they mean by that. And they cannot possibly mean it. Because the truth is, if people drank in low-risk ways, the alcohol industry would be destroyed. What they need is people to drink in very high-risk
ways. Yeah,
they've
got to get more people in that 10% group.
They've got to get more people in that
10%.
And that means, as it does with tobacco, young people.
Yeah.
It means they've got to get them while they're young, and that's one of the reasons why the college audience is so incredibly important to the alcohol industry.
Yeah, and you see it all over the place, like Miller Beer, Coors
right.
Beer, these people like, you know, having bikini floats all over the place and
right.
getting free beers and stuff.
And they've actually managed, when they use psychological research, to have young people link this in their minds with freedom, with rebellion, with this sort of thing, whereas what they're really doing, you know, is they're following orders. I mean, these young people who are lighting up and getting drunk, they're doing exactly what Anheuser-Busch wants them to do, what Philip Morris wants them to do. And yet they've been sort of, in this case, I think really brainwashed into thinking, hey, this is rebellion.
I'm a rebel.
Yeah,
I'm really showing these stiffs what a cool person I am.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well,
To me, Bob, that's one of the most awful things that's happening in a way, because I am a rebel. I mean, I'm all for rebellion and, you know, as you can imagine, and anti-authoritarianism and all of that. And to see it co-opted in this way, to see students who could be, and I know many students are, but I mean, who could be out there protesting what's going on in this country right now, could be taking to the streets, as indeed every thinking person should be these days, instead sort of rallying for their right to have kegs at fraternity parties is really sad.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Well, Gene, we've got about, as it usually happens, we've talked about 45 minutes or 50 minutes about how terrible
advertising is. Now in a minute, what can we do about it?
Yeah, now push, give us, what product can we buy to save us?
That's right, exactly. I happen to be selling something.
Yeah, buy your book.
Buy my book and it'll solve all your problems.
This is really the key question. How do we respond to this? If we share your concerns, if we think your criticism is on target, what do we do?
Well, there are many different things, and you know, there are many different ways to get involved in fighting back here. I have a website, GeneKilbourne.com, with an extensive resource list that has all kinds of organizations. One thing we can and must do is, of course, teach media literacy in our schools, teach our kids to be critical viewers starting in kindergarten. And as you know, you and I were at this wonderful conference in Albuquerque recently for ACME, the Action Coalition for Media Education, which is trying to rally people for that, to really try and teach media literacy. That's really important.
Now, if someone listening to this wanted to do that in their local schools, how would they go about that?
I think probably the simplest thing is go to my website, GeneKilbourne.com, and just get in touch with ACME or with
But also you just run for school board or go to your school board meeting.
That's the other thing, of course, is that people need to get involved locally in local politics.
If that's the sort of issue, you don't have to go to Washington and wait in line to meet a senator. You just run for school board or go to school board.
Right.
This is something you can actually do. It's not that hard.
Right.
It just takes a little bit of work. Because
a
lot of people can argue with you that we need media literacy once they're exposed to the importance of it.
But running, of course, well, then we can get in this whole tangent about local politics and how difficult it is to get any kind of coverage of these issues now that newspapers are owned by huge chains.
Yeah.
But that's a very important suggestion. So that is one thing that we can do. And we can get involved in other ways to resist. I mean, on campus, a lot of students these days are taking on the alcohol industry, for example, or are doing all kinds of educational programs or programs designed to change the norms, you know, or to challenge the belief that the norms are. Or these high-risk drinking. And so changing the environment. We need to address these issues as public health problems. You know, we've made tremendous success with tobacco because we addressed it as a public health problem and we took on the industry. I'd like to see us address the obsession with thinness as a public health problem.
Every medical group in the country now has come out and made it clear this is, if not the single most important public health issue, it's a severe crisis in our society.
It's a severe crisis. So, therefore, what can we do about it? Well, we could tax the diet commercials, and we could use the money to have counter-advertising and to fund programs in the schools the way we did with tobacco.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. And tax the junk food industry, too, for that matter, and use the money for honest information and for good nutritional programs in the schools and all of that. So those are some of the things. I mean, there's a lot of other things that we can do, too, but those are some of them. But addressing it as a public health issue, changing the environment, teaching people to become more media literate, I think those are all key.
What about the advertising itself? Should we just abolish it?
Well, I actually think that we should. The European Union now is debating a bill to ban all advertising directed at children. And I'm certainly in favor of that.
Television advertising.
Is it just television advertising?
So. Newspapers, but how many newspapers?
Well, of course, exactly. That's right. Not too many kids. But I think that would be extremely important to
try to fight that. They do that currently in Sweden and Greece Denmark and in Norway, too, where my wife's from. And it's quite extraordinary to go there and watch kids' programming without any ads on it.
It must be.
Especially because you get a lot of the American channels without ads. Hey, this isn't that bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it also means the shows are about half the length.
That's right. They would be. We had a rule in my house when my daughter was little that we wouldn't buy anything that was advertised on television.
I love that.
Yeah. So it's just because when you think about it, it saves a lot of money. Everything advertised to kids on television is bad for them. I can't think of anything that isn't. And so it just made it simple. And, you know, because my daughter being little didn't know that this was weird. And so that was just the way it was.
You know, as you say that, I was just thinking, this is an interview we couldn't have on a commercial station.
Indeed, we couldn't.
If people want to know why you need public and community and non-commercial broadcasting, this is exhibit A. You can't discuss this. It's funny, the only thing I've seen on TV critical of advertising outside of public broadcasting was on HBO, which I don't know if they do again now. It's a part of AOL, Time Warner Empire. But, you know, 10 or 12 years ago, they had a wonderful documentary on how advertising children constantly lies to children. And they actually exposed
Buy me that.
Yeah.
Buy me that. That's right. That was wonderful. I still use that.
Yeah. It's outstanding. But yeah, I haven't seen anything like that recently. So probably they got the word from the poobahs.
I bet they did.
That's not really kosher
probably
anymore.
Probably not. Yeah.
Okay. So you like the idea of no advertising to kids.
I love the idea of no advertising to kids.
How about the idea of making advertising have to prove it's telling the truth? I mean, holding some sort of truth statement.
That would end it, wouldn't it, right there?
Well, it's really altered. But, I mean, you know, putting the burden of – right now it seems like advertising, the burden of proof is on the government to prove they're lying or on competitors, not on them to prove they're telling the truth. I mean, to sort of switch the burden of proof so an advertiser's got some obligation to
– Well, also the whole idea of truth in advertising is that sort of an oxymoron because the – although – I mean, what the government is always talking about is verbal truth. And the real lies in advertising are visual. You know, it's the images that are the lies.
And so that's why it's so hard to regulate.
It's very hard to regulate.
Yeah, if you're showing like a beautiful woman in a bikini next to a lawnmower – now, they're not saying she's going to call you up for a date if you buy the lawnmower.
Right, right. So but they're really, implying it.
Yeah,
they're
but
implying
they're implying something there that has absolutely nothing to do with that product whatsoever.
Right, absolutely. Or a cigarette ad that features a waterfall, you know? I mean, they're not
or these
saying,
car ads. You never see car ads in the South Bronx. You know,
that's right. They're always out in nature.
I know.
The chief despoiler of our
or
national environment.
Put them like in the interstate outside of Chicago where you're backed up for 2 hours with exhaust filling your head.
You don't see those. You know, another important thing real quickly, Bob, is to get advertising out of our schools.
Yeah.
And there's a whole list of organizations on my website.
And these are doable things, too.
These are doable
things. Once people organize in these things, they win. It's not like they can be defended. They only can be successful to the extent people don't do anything.
That's right.
And
that's right.
They're shut up and shocked.
And most people feel powerless and overwhelmed and not feel like they can't really do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we can do things, small things. We're all busy. None of us has any time. But there are little things we can do that can make a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Are there any people in public life who've shown any interest in these issues that people could like call, you know, someone's showing leadership, or is this pretty much still a grassroots thing?
It's pretty much grassroots because when you think about it, by the time people really get high up in public life, they're so in bed with the big corporations that how can they take leadership on these issues?
Now, there is one group that we've had as a guest on the show, a guy named Gary Ruskin.
Gary Ruskin, I adore. Yeah, he's wonderful.
Commercial Alert.
He does wonderful
do great work.
Right.
For people who are concerned about too much advertising, too much commercials, and the effects of advertising, this is the one group I'm familiar with at the national level that's sort of leading constant fights.
Right. I mean, his latest thing right now is there's a new thing of putting ads on police cars.
I've seen that.
You know, that police cars are going to be bought by advertisers. And what a horrible idea this is. And Gary's leading the fight to sort of prevent this.
Well, and next they'll be tattooing ads on policemen's foreheads or something.
Or all of us. Or when our kids are born, we can sponsor them, you know?
This has been a pleasure having you. I could talk to you for 24 hours. We could do like a telethon.
I know,
it would
be fun.
Gene Kilbourn has been our guest today on Media Matters. It's been a pleasure having you here. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I'll be back 1 week from today, 167 hours. Please join me then. And I want to thank Ben Scott, my producer. Sayonara.